I have one short reading if you'd like to turn to Ephesians 4. I'm going to speak tonight on the subject of the gospel and culture. Now, when I say culture, I'm not speaking of culture in that some people are cultured, you know, a little bit uppity and appreciate the better things of life, and the rest of the people are rather humdrum. Nor am I thinking of culture simply in the sense of people in other countries do things in a different way, although I'm going to touch on that. We all have culture, we live in a culture, we live in a society, and really what I'm saying tonight is in some way connected with what I was saying this morning. The sort of society in which we live. All of it is the culture in which we live. So I'm going to be ranging over both an international view of different cultures, but also our own view, and just see how the gospel relates to these things. Now, in Ephesians chapter 4, when Paul in verse 17 starts speaking about the Gentiles, he is speaking about people in the society to which he addressed this letter. That is, this letter is written to Christians in Ephesus, and the society round about is like this. He says, "I affirm and testify in the Lord that you must no longer live as the Gentiles do, in the futility of their minds. They are darkened in their understanding, alienated from the life of God because of the ignorance that is in them due to the hardness of heart. They become callous." Just as well he wasn't around today, he'd be up before the race relations board in no time if he started to say all this. But this is what he's saying: they become callous. They've given themselves up to licentiousness. They're greedy to practice every kind of uncleanness. But you did not so learn Christ. Assuming, of course, that you have heard about him and were taught in him as the truth is in Jesus. He then goes on to give the equivalent verses in Ephesians that we read in Colossians this morning about putting off the old nature and putting off the new, which is being renewed or recreated in the likeness of God. I'm not going to speak on that tonight. I'm going to now address the next 40 minutes. I'm going to take every bit of that time because there's a lot of things I want to get through. This whole idea of culture. So if I can just broadly define it, it's the way of life in which we live together, communicate, exist. It includes all our patterns of thought, habit, custom, behavior, in short, our whole view of life. In other words, it's something that we acquire. It is not something we're born with. It is something that we get from the society in which we grow up. Now, once we've grasped that, we realize then that culture is relative, not absolute. It will change, it will fluctuate, and there will be grades of right and wrong and perceptions this way and that, because it's changing constantly. Our culture is changing constantly. Every culture is changing constantly, and they vary from one to the other. And so culture itself is not sacrosanct, it is not absolute, it's not fixed, and it's something we acquire and adjust as we go along. But it is the context in which you and I live, whether we like it or not, and it's the context in which we meet people, in which we communicate with them about Christ or the gospel. It's the environment in which we worship together, in which we meet Christ, and in which we serve in capacities in our society and so on. This is where we are. This is where we start from. Now, how does the gospel relate to all this? That's what I want to speak about. Just a couple of issues to talk about at the beginning. One concerns us and the Bible. Now, there are lots of funny things when you read the Bible. You read the Bible sometimes, and that, you know, looks a bit odd saying that sort of thing to us. But we must realize, of course, that the Bible was written in a culture, and if most of the culture of the Bible, of course, all the Old Testament to start with, was in the Hebrew culture, not our culture. We must accept that, and we must understand that. We don't have to agree with them, incidentally. We don't have to agree with all the customs they had. They had a few crazy customs. They had one custom where if a man died and he had no children, then his brother had to have some sexual relations with his widowed wife, hoping that she can reproduce a child that will now grow up and bear the name of the father. I'm jolly glad we don't have that requirement in our culture. But they had it, and you've got lots of things. Washing of feet, and they didn't sit around on chairs like we do. They sort of reclined at tables. You've got all things coming through the Bible, and we've just got to make allowance for that sort of thing. But what some people do is then try to twist the gospel to fit into their own culture, because they're a bit embarrassed over some of these things in the Bible. And so they start to argue, well, what if Christ was a Chinese or something like this? Well, the point is, he wasn't a Chinese. And that's the end of the argument, as far as I can see. God has to start somewhere, and he could have started with the Chinese or the Indians or the Americans, but he didn't. He happened to start with these people in Israel, and it wasn't because they were better than anybody else. In fact, he says in one place, they were worse in many ways than a lot of other people. But you've got to start somewhere, and all the nations and languages and peoples are different, so whichever one you choose is going to be different from all the others. And he happened to choose that nation of Israel, and Christ was born into that nation, and so we're stuck with it. You hear people talking about a black Christ or a Negro Christ and try to invent a new sort of Christ. It's a waste of time. He wasn't black, he wasn't Negro, he wasn't white either, incidentally. He wasn't a European, he wasn't a Caucasian. He was somewhere in between. He was one of these Middle Eastern people. If you see pictures of all those people through those Middle Eastern areas in the Arab regions of the world, you've got an idea of the general type of ethnic group into which he was born. And that's the way it is. Why was he a male? Well, you've got to be one or the other, actually. We only have males and females. If he was a female, we wouldn't be a male. If he'd male, he's not a female. And again, we're stuck with it. So there's no sense getting uptight over the fact that he happened to be of a certain sex and of a certain nationality and spoke a certain language and lived in a certain culture. That's the way it is. So that's the first thing I want to mention. Not to get too uptight over some of the things we come across in the Bible. We just got to accept that the Bible was written and the people lived in a certain culture and climate. The second thing I just want to clear away is when we speak to other people. Now, we've got to realize once again that we are communicating the gospel. We come from a certain culture, and those people may live in a certain culture, and people like myself who spend a lot of time in other countries obviously are aware of some of the sensitivities. Now, we've got to be very careful that we don't perpetuate a Western culture and impose it upon other people as if somehow this culture is Christian. It's not Christian at all. If anybody thinks that our culture is Christian, then he must be walking around blind. Our culture is a disgrace in many of the attitudes and lots of the behavior that happens to go on here. There is a perception, of course, that Western civilization is Christian, but I think Western civilization is just about shot to pieces. And if it did have some Christian association once, it doesn't seem to have too many of those associations now. So we have to be careful and not assume that somehow our culture is superior to someone else's because of some sort of tradition that may have come from Christian roots a few centuries ago. Now, the danger is, of course, that when some people go into other countries with this attitude and then they impose this Western culture upon them. The result is that you get Christians who become jaded or who become very legalistic, actually. That's what happens. We know that Jesus said to the Pharisees, he says, you cross land and sea to make a proselyte, and when you've made him a proselyte, he becomes more a child of the devil than you were. And I'm afraid that happens sometimes, that people impose Western ideas and habits and manners of dress upon people, and then these people think that this is the way it ought to be done. In fact, I was showing some pictures once of some country I'd been to, and some person said to me afterwards, oh, he said it was lovely to see those Christians, and it was especially nice to see they're dressed the way we are. And I thought, oh, goodness me, where has this person come from? He wouldn't have got on too well with Jesus or Paul, and he wouldn't have gone at all with Abraham and David and lots of other people who obviously dressed differently, ate differently, slept differently, and did all sorts of other things differently. You see, the person thought that somehow this is the superior culture and is to be imposed upon others. The other danger with this is that people don't learn to think Christianly. They simply learn to think, or they don't learn to think at all, really. But they find that they don't want to accept the things imposed upon them. And that because the roots are not in the scriptures, very often they then get some way of trying to express their religious beliefs through some of the customs of the country they're in. And what happens is you get syncretism, where you get a mixture of Christianity in a very superficial sense with some of the other religious ideas, and what comes out is not a local version of Christianity, and nor is it a proper version of Christianity. It's something in between which is mixed up. The best example of this in the Bible is Baalism in the Old Testament, where the people of Israel came into a different country different culture. They saw these Baal practices around. They saw some things that were similar to what they thought they liked. They married the two, and so they finished up worshipping God as if he was a super Baal. And so Baalism was the classic Old Testament expression of a syncretistic type of religion where these two things are brought together. So I'm just clearing the decks a little bit here, because if we're not careful, then we can create these problems. Create the problems of legalism, of immature Christians, of syncretism, or something else, if we don't have a very strong perception of what the gospel really is, and not think that somehow it has to be married to any culture. So what I'm saying, I can summarize this. One, we don't think that we have to take our culture as the only vehicle that can convey the gospel, but nor do we think that the culture into which we're going is the only vehicle that can accept the gospel. And in the end, culture becomes more important than the gospel itself. So that brings me to one of the main points I want to make, and that is that all cultures need the gospel. No culture is a perfect expression of Christianity. Now, we saw this morning that we are made in the image of God, but the image has been spoiled and we're not what we should be. And so the whole human race is off the rails. All of it needs cleansing. The whole world lies in the evil one, says John in 1 John chapter 5, verse 19. Here in this book of Ephesians that I just read, Paul says, "You once walked according to the course of this world, following the prince of the power of the air, the spirit that is now at work in the sons of disobedience." All cultures, all peoples, all nations are affected. However, because we are made in the image of God, some elements might be okay, because not everything was totally black. We still have capacities for good. We have capacities to love. We still have capacities to be kind to people. We still have the ability to rise to some of the nobler things in life. And that applies, of course, to other cultures as well. And so some elements may be preserved, and they may be transformed by the gospel. When the gospel comes to a culture, it does not come as the guest of the culture. It comes as the judge of the culture. Now, I ran into somebody in one of our churches only last year when we were talking about something in relation to another country, and there was a practice that I thought was wrong, and I had said so, but this other person defended the wrongdoing, which was a fairly obvious sort of wrongdoing, I would have thought, but they said, "Oh, but that's their culture." I said, "Well, so what? It doesn't make it right simply because it's their culture. I mean, there are things in our culture that are wrong. It doesn't make them right and say, oh, well, you know, that's the way it is in our country." There are things in every culture that are right and that are wrong. We can't excuse the behaviour of people in other countries or the behaviour of anybody in our own country simply on the basis that it's their culture. The gospel comes not to be moulded by the culture, but to mould the culture. Not to become as a servant of the culture, but as the master of the culture, as the judge of the culture, and I should hope the redeemer of the culture in some way. Culture itself is not neutral. There's always a conflict between good and evil. Now, Christianity frees certain elements of culture, you might say, from cruelty, from injustice, from dishonesty, and other sorts of evil practices. Now, that raises a bit of a problem. I've had several people say to me, because I go around saying about some of the things that are happening in Africa, and some of those countries, if you went in, say, Zambia or Kenya, and asked the people what religion they were, about 80% of them would say Christian. And so the nominal Christian population in those countries is considerable. In fact, it might be more than what it is in our country. And then people say, well, why are they still in such a mess? Why are they still corrupt? Why are all these problems of mismanagement and injustice and corruption going on if there's such a large Christian community there? But I say, well, what about our own country? It depends which way you look at things. Here we are in our country where we have all sorts of things going on, and we've got a large Christian community and we're part of it. Well, we have a gay and lesbian Mardi Gras, which you wouldn't get away with, incidentally, in those African countries, because they wouldn't allow it. And you say, well, where are the Christians? Why can this thing happen in a country where Christians are supposed to be an influence on the culture? So we've got to be careful in criticizing other cultures that we don't excuse ourselves the same sorts of things are happening everywhere. There are good and there are bad things. We would hope that the Christianity might be an influence for good that will liberate people from some of these bondages. But we have to be honest and admit that the culture in which we live is pretty murky, and we can't claim too much for it that is very positive or wholesome. So when I talk about the gospel, my emphasis is not on the cultural context, it's more on what I would call the human context. Now, I just come back from Kenya. I was running some talks there, and a lot of people were coming and saying, how do we reach Indians? How do we reach Hindus? Because although they're evangelizing among their Negro African peoples, the Indians, who are a fairly substantial minority group in Kenya, they're not being reached at all. My answer is that you reach them the same as you reach anybody else. I lived among Buddhists for a long time, working in my missionary activity. But basically the way I went about evangelizing Buddhists was no different from what you should go about evangelizing Hindus or Muslims or anybody else. It's good to be aware of where these people are coming from, but basically you simply present the gospel the same, because the problem is the human problem of sin. We don't go attacking the cultural or the religious issues, which are secondary. We go to the main issue, which is the problem of human sin. We have rebelled against God, we're under his judgment, and that's the problem with our society. So I don't think of the conflict as being a conflict between the Western mindset and the Eastern mindset. I see it as a conflict between the mindset which sees everything only in terms of the material and the rational things in which we live, and the mindset which is of God, which sees things in terms of the spiritual, made in the image of God, and God's perspective on things. The problems, as I see them, are universal. Universally the same. I've been in lots and lots of countries, dozens of countries all around the world, and really human nature is a remarkably consistent commodity. It's very consistent. No matter what culture or what religious background these people are coming from, the only difference is that they take a slightly different expression. But the underlying problem, whether it's selfishness or greed or jealousy or whatever it happens to be, the underlying problem is the same. It just takes a different expression. And so what we have to do is take the gospel as it was given and apply it, realizing that the truth of God does not change. Now, the format in which we present it may be adjusted, obviously, as you see with the Apostle Paul when he preached in a synagogue, or when he preached in a marketplace with people who were not Jewish at all. Sometimes he preached in the Old Testament, sometimes he talked about the revelation God had given in nature, he talked about different things. But the gospel that he preached was not really any different. The gospel must change our behavior, it must change our worldview, it must change the way we see things. The trouble is, of course, that we are very much influenced by where we are, and we see other things out there very bad, and we don't see the problems ourselves. I had this emphasized for me once when I had an Indian fellow staying with me in Brisbane here, and he was shocked when he found the amount of divorce that there was in churches. You don't see that in India, he said. Well, I didn't try to defend the situation, but I did think it was worth reminding him that when I was in India, I saw in almost every city that I went in, Christians were going to law against other Christians because they had a fight over something. There was litigation and there were court cases all over the place. It was very consistent. Oh yes, he said, well, that's the only way you can deal with a lot of these people. They're so bad, some of these people, you've got to take them to court. I said, well, we don't sort of have that type of thing here. So you don't have divorce, which is a problem here, but then you have all this litigation, which is not such a problem here. And so he started to see things from another view and realized that we tend to be blind to some of the problems in our own society. The Bible's cultural features don't obscure the truth of the message. This is important to grasp, because I've met some people who want to twist the Bible. They want to juggle it around a little bit to fit the culture where they're going. I've heard of people in Papua New Guinea, they say, well, there's no sense talking about a lamb as a sacrifice because they don't have lambs, they don't have sheep up there, so they substitute the word pig. Well, I don't think that's helping at all. no matter what culture you go to, there are going to be lots of things in the Bible that are not familiar in that culture. Even here, I have never seen a sacrifice. In all my life, I've never seen an animal sacrificed. So what are we going to do? Take it out the Bible and get something to do with our culture to replace it? I've never seen anybody in Roman armor. So what are we going to do? Change all the stuff about the armor of God because I've never seen Roman armor? No. What we have to do is take the Bible exactly as it is, and if people haven't seen a lamb, or they haven't seen Roman armor, or they don't know what a sacrifice is, then we just simply got to explain it. Show some pictures or do something. This way, we can remain true to the Bible, but yet be sympathetic to the needs and requirements of the people we're speaking with. Even in our own culture, we have to be very careful. Father is a very common picture in the Bible, a very common picture of God. But a lot of people in our society, their understanding of Father is not good at all. Lots of people, the only Father they know is not in any way a good illustration of the Heavenly Father. Well, we can't change the Heavenly Father to something else. But we have got to say that the picture they've got is a very inadequate one and try to give a better picture. Adoption. New birth. Adoption in our culture is something different from what's in the Bible. But we don't change the Bible, we simply explain the Bible a bit more clearly than we were before. The new birth. People use it about politicians. He got clapped out in the state elections, and a couple of years later he bobs up in a federal election and they say he's a born-again politician. And born-again means recycled in the popular terminology. But that's not the biblical terminology. We have to take note of these sorts of things. Coming now to speak a bit more specifically about culture and religion, we have this danger, as I said, of being coloured by our local culture. But we have to be aware that even in our own place, and even in our own country, we are all affected by the society in which we live. We've just read in Ephesians what Paul said about first century Ephesus, but to be perfectly honest, it's not all that much different from 21st century Australia. In 1 Peter, Peter talks about us being redeemed from the worthless manner of life handed down to us by our forebears, which is another way of saying the awful culture in which we happen to find ourselves, all the sinful elements of it. God wants us to be redeemed from all that sort of thing. Paul, when he was writing to the Corinthians, he said, "You remember what you once were. You were slaves of sin, and you were free in regard to righteousness. You did what you liked. You didn't bother about what was right and wrong. You were slaves of sin. But what return did you get from the things of which you are now ashamed?" So he again is acknowledging that the culture without the gospel is only leading people into further and further difficulty. It's a mire, it's a bog, it's a muddy pit in which you get caught. And someone's got to pull us out of it. And that someone, of course, is Jesus Christ. Now, sometimes the line between culture and religion is very hard to draw. It was interesting when I lived in Thailand to see the Thai Christians discussing things. Should they or should they not do these things? And some had this opinion and some had that. And now we just sit back and listen to what they were saying. You have the same in the Bible. Paul talks about food offered to idols. Should you eat it or should you not? There was this local custom, but then Christian faith taught something else. Some people saw things one way and some people saw things slightly differently, and so they came to different opinions on some of these issues. We're faced with things. Now, we just had one ourselves, Guy and I. Someone was suggesting that we join one of these clubs. There are lots of them, football clubs, sports clubs and so on, where you get good meals. You pay an annual, very modest annual subscription, and you can get really good meals that are better than Sizzlers and cheaper. A lot of Christians in some of the churches in our part of town are members. Well, we talked about it, just the two of us. We didn't talk to anybody else, and we just declined. We just said, no, we didn't want to. We didn't want to make a fuss over it. But I'll just tell you that our reasons were, one, I didn't want to be part of something where I was the beneficiary of the fruits of gambling. Because why these clubs can put on such a good deal is that they're financed largely by poker machines. And I think that the gambling thing is one of the rottenest things in our society. It's right through our culture, but it's bad. And so that was a reason why we didn't want to be part of it. The second reason I didn't want to be part of it was that we're trying to practice hospitality. And we bring non-Christian people, and we bring people who are bereft and people who are bits of outcasts. We like to bring them into our home. And we try to get other Christians to be hospitable to people. And it's belting your head against a brick wall the whole time. People are just simply not hospitable. Christians are not hospitable. And yet the Bible tells us, I don't know how many times, to feed the hungry, to be kind to those who are lonely, and so it goes on, to practice hospitality. And people won't do it. And then they'll march off to Sizzlers or to a club or somewhere to feed themselves. And so I'm thinking to myself, this is an element in our culture which I find incompatible with the way I would like to live my Christianity. Now, I'm not going to judge other people if they see it differently. What I'm saying is, we've got to look at our culture, look at our faith, and realize that sometimes it's difficult to know where to draw the line. And you and I may draw the line in different places, in a whole range of activities. What do you do on Sunday? Well, years ago, you didn't do anything except go to church. But now, people are much more flexible. Does this mean you do anything? Once again, you've got to examine a whole lot of issues and work out where exactly to draw the line. So words have different meanings. Ideas have different meanings. Culturally acceptable practices have different meanings depending on the way we see them, the way we react to them, and so forth. However, our main responsibility is not to our culture or to the convenience that it offers us. Our main responsibility is to Jesus Christ and the discipleship that he's called us to, which is a discipleship of self-denial for the sake of Christ and the gospel. And so there are all sorts of customs and habits that are going to crop up along the way where we are going to have to make a decision. We're not to be judgmental of each other who see things differently, or even in another culture where they have customs that we may think are not the best. Well, they've got to work that out themselves just the same as we have to work ours out ourselves. The same thing happened in the Bible. There are all sorts of strange things. I mentioned some at the beginning. There was a trial by ordeal. There was greeting one another with a holy kiss, which people do with great fervour in some countries. We don't do it at all. Well, not males to males anyway. Okay, that's the way they did it. What we realise is that God is the Lord of history. He's the Lord of culture. He is supreme. And what he has called us to is faith, repentance, commitment to him, discipleship, self-denial, and all of these fundamental issues which are imposed upon us as those who accept the gospel. And then we have to work out ourselves how we live within our culture. One of the things that bothers me is that so many people, not only in Australia and our culture, but in other cultures, whether it's in a Buddhist culture in Asia or in an African culture, there's so many Christians just accept things without examining them. Our first obligation is as disciples of Jesus Christ. He called us to submit to his lordship. When we go to these cultures, we can have dialogue with people. We can talk with them. It doesn't necessarily mean that we accept all the things that they believe. As soon as you mention dialogue with other religions, some people suddenly, they nearly have a heart attack. Some Christians, they get all uptight over this. Nobody's saying you've got to agree with people. If I'm talking to a Buddhist, I landed on a plane with a Muslim on my way overseas once, and we got locked into a very animated discussion. He was giving his views fairly forthrightly, and so was I. We were dialoguing. I wasn't accepting what he said, and I was making it very clear where I was coming from. There's only one name under heaven given among men whereby we must be saved, Jesus Christ. The Lordship of Christ, commitment to him, confession of faith. He was coming from a different angle. We're having discussion, not to reach agreement or to water us both down to meet in the middle. This is what we do when we meet people from other religions. All of these religions, in a way, have retained part of the original revelation God gave. Now, we mustn't think that there's no good in any of these religions. They are not the way of salvation. But as I said this morning, there's good and bad in just about everything. Let's take Buddhism again. Now, Buddhism is a totally false religion. It doesn't bring eternal life. Jesus Christ is the only way. But there are some good teachings in Buddhism. For example, the five main rules of Buddhism: you don't kill, you don't commit adultery, you don't steal, you don't tell lies, and you don't covet. I think I might have them right. Now, they're all very good things. Incidentally, those prohibitions, the five things that are prohibited, are in fact the five most distinctive characteristics of Thai society. but it's teaching, it's giving good teaching. But people are not following the teaching. And so there's no salvation in it. We don't need good teaching to make us better. We need somebody to save us from drowning. We need somebody to jump in and pull us out. Not someone who's going to tell us what to do. So people are telling them what to do, and the things that they're saying are good. But they're not a way of salvation. So that's what I'm saying. That in all these different places you go, you'll find that some people are saying things that are sensible, and some people are saying things that are distinctly not sensible. But what we have to do is bridge the gap. And so, like the Apostle Paul, when he was in Athens, he found the territory. He said, well, I know you Epicureans believe this, and you Stoics believe that. And I quote from your poets. Fair enough, what these guys said. Not too bad. But he said, they don't know what they're really talking about, because it's actually God who is in control. In fact, he said, I saw an altar to the unknown God. Well, he said, I'm going to tell you about him. And so he picks up on some of the things that their poets had said, or some of the ideas they had, which had some truth in them, but he said they are simply a very faded, a very dim reflection of what the true God has really done. The image of God is still there in human beings, but it's been spoiled, it's been distorted, it's been broken up, it's been messed around, but it's still there. So there's something to work on. We've got a point of contact with people. Not to compromise the gospel to their culture, but to see that there is something bigger and better, and to bring them out of darkness into light. When we preach the gospel, it doesn't mean we export our culture. In fact, we try to get rid of as much as we can. But try to show what are the important issues. I had a case in India once where I met some person. In fact, I had two cases. Both of them actually were PhDs, young men. And one of them, he was married, and he was one of my interpreters, and he was a very helpful man in many ways. And I said to him, you know, just in conversation, I said, where did you meet your wife? And he said, on the station the day before we were married. I was a little taken aback. It was an arranged marriage. Another time I was staying in India, and I met another fellow at the guest house. He'd just come back from the United States. He'd been 5 years over there, got his PhD, he was a Christian. What are you going to do? He said, I'm going up to such and such a place, and I'm going to get married and move into an evangelism pastoral ministry. And so I said, oh, well, who's your wife? He said, I don't know yet. He says, my parents are working that out. Now, here were people who were highly educated, very intelligent people, very gifted, and they just took it as read that that was the way it was. Now, we choose our own, but I'm not convinced that we've made a better job of it in the long run, because we seem to, many anyway, in our society, seem to have made very poor choices or changed their mind fairly quickly. The Bible doesn't tell you how to get a wife. It doesn't say that the Indians were right in having it arranged, or that we're right in choosing our own. You see, this is where we've got to separate what the Bible says with what our culture happens to be. I'm jolly glad, actually, that we can choose our own here. Suits me fine. But I'm not to deceive myself that this is more Christian than my brothers and sisters in India, because that is a totally irrelevant issue concerning the Bible's teaching about marriage. The Bible's teaching is not how you get your marriage partner, it's how you behave towards your marriage partner. And it's very clear then how husbands are to behave and how wives are to behave. That's the Christian thing. So what I'm saying is, that's where we've got to look at what the Christian teaching is, and then what are the cultural bits and pieces that go around it, and not get ourselves confused. We've got to separate the core from the trappings that surround it. Well, it's been a little bit of an excursion around a lot of areas tonight, but at least I hope we've come to one understanding, and that is that culture is not sacrosanct, it is not absolute. We don't adapt our principles or our faith to the culture, but neither do we walk all over it. But we see that within it are the possibilities for making known the one absolute, which is the gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ. And we don't worry too much about how people are culturally adapting. What I'm worried about is that they are becoming disciples of Jesus Christ. And then those cultural adaptations, they can work them out themselves, whether they want to be a member of this club or whether they find that that particular thing is something that their religion doesn't allow them to do. We get people's roots into the Bible. Now, when Jesus came into the world, the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. And now he says, as I came into the world, I now send you into the world. That's what he says at the end of John chapter 20. I'm sending you into the world. So he became incarnate. He enculturated himself, or he indigenized himself, or whatever word you want to use. But he came into a certain context, and he lived in that context. Then he ate the food of those people, and he slept the way they slept, and he traveled the way they traveled, and he spoke the language that they spoke, but he made known the message of God in that setting. He didn't see it as something negotiable, but he came as one who revealed God in the place where God put him. Now that's what you and I got to do. We've got to follow the example of Jesus. He's placed us in this particular country. We've got to learn what it is to love these people, to mingle with these people, to know all these people around us. He doesn't want to take us out of the world. He wants to leave us in the world to do something for him. That's what it means to communicate the gospel in our own culture. He may send us to another country. Then we've got to start all over again in trying to find how they live. But always we are taking the gospel, which alone is going to transform people. God sent his son into this world, and now he sends you and me out into this world in the same way. We take his gospel, his message of life, so that other people become his disciples.